CFUV 101.9 FM, 104.3 on the cable dial, and you know we're heard around the world at cfuv.uvic.ca. Well, Canada's new recognition of its role in the world as a war-fighting nation expanded recently with its deployment of warplanes and naval crews to the North African nation of Libya. Unlike in the United States, a motion was brought before the Canadian legislature and breezed through the House with nary a word of protest. What made this motion pass so easily and how Ottawa justifies an unprovoked assault on a foreign country comes down to a little heard of mechanism of international diplomacy known as responsibility to protect. Anthony Fenton is a journalist, researcher, and scholar currently completing postgraduate studies at York University. He is the co-author with Eve Engler of Canada in Haiti, Waging War on the Poor Majority, and his articles on foreign policy have appeared at the Interpress Service news agency Asia Times Online, The Dominion, Foreign Policy in Focus, Mother Jones, and many other publications. Fenton has also conducted extensive research into the authors and aims of the Responsibility to Protect doctrine, Anthony Fenton, and what the Libyan intervention means in the first half. And Don Staniford is an award-winning author and environmental campaigner. He's the recipient of the Roderick Brown Regional Prize for co-authoring with Alexandra Morton and Stephen Hume, A Stain Upon the Sea. And he won, too, the British Environmental Media Award in 2002. Staniford is no stranger to the Salmon Wars here in British Columbia, having successfully defended himself in court against charges by the salmon farming industry, and is now faced with, along with his organization Global Alliance Against Industrial Aquaculture, a new legal challenge mounted by Norwegian fish farming giant Cermaq. Don Staniford and Something Smelling Rotten in BC, perhaps in the second half. And Victoria Street News publisher and CFUV broadcaster Janine Bancroft will be here at the bottom of the hour to bring us up to speed with the current views from the city streets and beyond. But first, Anthony Fenton and the Responsibility to Protect. Stick around. Well, welcome back to the program, Anthony.
I agree to be here. Thanks, Chris.
Well, it's my pleasure, of course. Now, Anthony, intervention in Libya, good thing, bad thing?
Can you repeat that again?
Good thing, bad thing, our intervention.
Oh, good thing, bad thing, yeah. My personal opinion overall is absolutely a bad thing. Mm-hmm. This is a question, is this an imperialist intervention or an intervention of imperialists, or both?
You're a little low. Anthony, you're a little...
rattling began on this, on the R2P front, as your intro indicated.
Well, Anthony, can I cut in there for a second, buddy?
Yes, sir.
You're a little low. Can I get you to speak up a little bit?
Okay, is this any better?
That's a lot better, yeah, thanks. Yeah, sorry, now you were mentioning the R2P?
Yes, I'm on the International Coalition for the Responsibility to Protect listserv. I receive their broadcasts, on a semi-weekly basis, and basically the stage was set for R2P to be applied to Libya probably first officially in mid-February when it was basically cited the Security Council recalled Libya's responsibility to protect third week of February. This happened in the context of a number of the responsibility to protect key lobby organizations, the International Coalition for the R2P being one of them, basically undertaking yet another propaganda onslaught to attempt to invoke this very nascent doctrine. Doctrine without a home in the sense that, as we've discussed on the show before, it's been a while, you may or not recall, but in 2005, the UN General Assembly basically agreed that R2P could be put on the agenda and agreed that this doctrine that had been developed by scholars and international humanitarian legal advisors and so forth, on the initiative of the Canadian government beginning in 2001, that they agreed sort of tentatively to continue to debate it within the UN. And And ever since 2005, what they've been seeking is the opportunity to what they say operationalize the doctrine in a real life, a real real scenario whereby they would have the legitimacy they want or perceived legitimacy, and where they would have public opinion on their side in order to execute a so-called R2P mission. And Libya provided the first sort of what they would say credible example, credible opportunity to do so. And that's what we've seen sort of executed since the March 18th Resolution 1973 by the U.N. Security Council, which specifically, explicitly incorporated the R2P language of civilian protection into the resolution. Now, I remember, Chris, when I was down in Caracas, Venezuela, just after Obama was elected in November 2008, and my presentation on a panel on was called Media Terrorism, I think it was called. It was a conference held by the broadcaster Telesur. I'm not proud to say that I was able to foresee this, but I predicted that with this incoming Obama administration, after the 8 years of the previous Bush administration, and this emphasis on the neoconservative unilateral intervention, what we're already seeing was a shift from within the U.S. sort of national security state, within the intellectual apparatus of it, that they were explicitly calling for the need to sort of reinvigorate and renew the empire. And one way to do so was to shift from this language of unilateralism to a language of smart power, and the types of interventions that the Clinton administration was known for, so-called successfully executing, such as in Yugoslavia in the late 1990s, and that there was being built around Obama sort of a base of intellectual support in the form of people like Samantha Powers and Susan Rice, who's the current U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, Anne-Marie Slaughter, who was in the State Department working under Clinton before she actually fairly abruptly quit due to her known ties with Gaddafi back in February, and then turned around quickly and called in an op-ed for this no-fly zone before it actually happened. But Obama administration, as it was incoming, was surrounding himself with these characters, and it was clear to me at the time that they were going to seek just the first opportunity to sort of resurrect and breathe new life into the doctrine of so-called humanitarian intervention, and that is exactly what we're seeing and what we've been seeing unfold for the last month and a half now.
Well, you mentioned that the Clinton administration and the Obama administration seems to be running along a parallel track, a mirror image, a shadow maybe. The humanitarian intervention doctrine, I'll say unofficially, was how Yugoslavia was justified, and I'll put square quotes around that, way back when, and it was a bad taste that came after Yugoslavia that I've always believed made a new rebranding of the response of humanitarian intervention necessary, and thus is born the responsibility to protect. Many Canadians, though, think that this was a Canadian initiative, though, even though Lloyd Axelworthy was a major part of bringing this forward, who really is the author of R2P?
Well, yeah, I mean, just think of it this way: knowing this is a dilemma that the U.S. has had as long as it's had sort of imperial designs in the world, and so since Monroe Doctrine, Franklin Delano Roosevelt expressed the dilemma with, for example, R2P interventions in Haiti in the early 20th century, in Nicaragua and Dominican Republic in the early 20th century, the problem was that these interventions were all well and good, but the problem was that there was a perception that the U.S. was going it alone, and that if the U.S. empire was to be able to continue to carry out these types of interventions, it needed to at least have the perception of legitimacy. It needed to do it in all possible cases with the coalition of the willing. And so this idea has been around for a long time. And in the case of creating the conditions for the R2P doctrine, what was critical was that the U.S. could not appear to be the intellectual authors of the doctrine itself, and so they basically outsourced it to Canada. Canada somehow, even though Canada's either been an extension of one empire, the British Empire, or through its policies, de facto extension of another empire, the U.S. Empire, nevertheless has a legitimacy in the world and a reputation that stands somewhat distinct from the U.S., you know, Canada, you know, this whole peacekeeping tradition that we're all familiar with. And so Canada was sort of tasked to spearhead the front man for the RCP doctrine as it was being drawn up. But critically, the funding for the seed funding came from primarily U.S.-based philanthropic foundations, liberal philanthropic foundations that have a history of supporting just this type of liberal imperialism. And if you trace sort of the funding ties that have been very important to keeping, giving R2P doctrine a lifeline from the original meetings in 2000, 2001, up to the UN vote in 2005, and then after 2005, which is really the most recent stage and most important stage, where they've been trying to operationalize it. Now, these R2P activists, with generous funding from these very same and other new funders who've come along, primarily based in the U.S., have been going around the world holding strategic high-level meetings. They've been creating R2P centers regionally all around the world in an attempt to basically, as I said earlier, operationalize this new doctrine. And so the important thing is, I think you're implying in the question, is that the hidden hand behind the creation of the R2P was the U.S. hand, and that's why there's actually been bipartisan support for it. When in 2005, at a critical stage, when it was going through the U.N., Newt Gingrich, of all people, U.S. Ambassador to the U.N. at the time, John Bolton, neocon himself, both of these guys, potential Republican presidential candidates, by the way, 2012, both of them endorsed R2P. And at the same time, clearly, it had the support of the Democratic side of the aisle. And so behind the scenes, the U.S. has supported this, but it couldn't have supported it. Their hands had to appear to be clean. And so Canada entered the picture and helped sort of carry it along and keep breathing life into it at necessary and critical moments.
Well, if you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio on CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria, 104.3 on the cable dial, and CFUV.uvic.ca on the internet everywhere else. I'm speaking tonight with Anthony Fenton, and Anthony is a journalist, a researcher, a scholar currently completing postgrad studies at York. He's co-author with Eve Engler of Canada in Haiti, Waging War on the Poor Majority, and his articles on foreign policy have appeared at the Internet Press, or Interpress Service, rather, news agency, Asia Times Online, The Dominion, Foreign Policy in Focus, Mother Jones, and many others. Now, Anthony, I guess I'm not even going to be terribly naive, I suppose, of me to even suggest that behind the R2P, that is the responsibility to protect doctrine, that there is an underlying noble motive. That, you know, we saw how the Libya situation was presented. Gaddafi helping things along by standing up on television, if the translation can be believed, saying that he was going to go house to house, closet to closet, to root out all of his enemies. So it made it seem like, well, somebody has to do something, or there's going to be some kind of horrible massacre here. But is there any indication that there is truly good-hearted motives behind the authorship of R2P, or is this just another way for the powerful to get their fingers into the resources of the poor?
Well, the biggest problem with R2P figures pretty clearly identified. The one venue that occurred with respect to actually seeing a legitimate debate over UN, because that was sort of one of the main things, is that this is a very one-sided debate all along the R2P doctrine sort of lifespan. When Mescal Viscota Brockman, the Nicaraguan former Sandinista, was president of the UN General Assembly, one of the last things he did before his tenure ended was he hosted a debate inside the UN General Assembly, and they invited Jean Brickman, author of Humanitarian Imperialism, and as well as Noam Chomsky, to debate some of the key R2P lobbyists. And basically, Chomsky summed it up nicely when he said, R2P, it's a great idea, right? Who wants to see civilian populations massacred? Nobody wants to see that. But he said the problem is that it's applied selectively, and that there's this problem. The most important problem is that of double standards, and Libya is no exception in that case. Now, one of the key international humanitarian law legal scholars who was actually involved in the creation of the R2P doctrine was Richard Falk, and Richard Falk has come out explicitly against the invocation of R2P in the case of Libya. In fact, he wrote, and specifically speaking to your question there, regarding the mass atrocity pretext, because there are four situations, if we take R2P at face value, that qualify for R2P-like situations. Those are genocide, war crimes, ethnic cleansing, and crimes against humanity. Falk basically says that there is little evidence, quoting him, of such wrath extending beyond the regime's expected defense of the established order, and that, quoting Falk, there was no firm evidence of a genocidal intention on Gaddafi's part. And he concludes that this is the UN Resolution 1973 is almost certain in the future to be regarded as a poor precedent, because although it is legal, because it is actually an approved resolution, it's not legitimate because it's neither politically prudent nor morally acceptable. And interestingly, Falk is not the only prominent legal scholar to oppose the resolution and oppose the no-fly zone, which isn't, you know, it's not just the no-fly zone, of course, we got to stress that. They already basically violated their own resolution when they began bombing their bombing campaign. But Michael Walzer, the theorist of the just war, has said this is the wrong intervention, saying that it's unclear what the purpose is, there's no end game, there's no significant Arab support for the attacks, this is not a humanitarian intervention to stop a massacre, and that the overthrow of tyrants such as Gaddafi and the establishment of democracy have to be local work. And he says that the military attack, this is Walzer still, the military attack of the current scale that we're seeing is, quote, defensible only in the most extreme cases, which Libya is not. And yet another legal scholar, Michael W. Doyle, who ironically is the head of the UN Democracy Fund, which is an institution that George Bush helped create in 2005, he wrote an article called The Folly of Protection, arguing many of these same points, you know, basically saying that a legitimate and lawful outcome to this intervention is far from assured, and that that R2P specifically precludes intervention in cases of civil disorders and coups, and that is effectively what we're seeing. This is a civil war that we have declared war ourselves in, and that there's no credible or legitimate reason for us to be doing so.
Well, Anthony, when you mentioned the four points inherent in the R2P, do all four of these have to be met theoretically before action can be taken? And if so, how does genocide qualify in the case of Libya? Where, I mean, is this like one tribe against another? It doesn't seem like there's any identifiable racial attacks against any groups.
No, and that's exactly the case. It's not all four. It's any one of the four, and none of those four are clearly meeting the justification standard.
So just
which is,
one.
Which is what these scholars are saying, yeah.
Just one of those precepts then need to be met before R2P can be considered then.
Right, yeah. And so, so on technical grounds, according to these people, and I agree, they should not have invoked the R2P principle, but that was very clearly that this is the point, I think, and that this is a R2P is a political doctrine first, humanitarian doctrine second, and that's the contradiction here. And you can see the politicization of it in the language that's employed, the very deliberate language being used to try. And in fact, you know, I was just reading the daily Pentagon briefing, and you should see the language of civilian protection. They're very careful to maintain this notion that they are there to protect civilians. When we know from history, you know, and unfortunate precedents before this, that there are always civilian costs when in the name of protecting civilians. And so, there's this contradiction that this is a political doctrine. And that this is the most dangerous. That is the most dangerous precedent being set here, because. This is a high risk scenario for the R2P lobbyists and advocates, because if this goes south on them, this is going to be the precedent that they have to hang their hat on. Because remember when they invaded Iraq, belatedly, Blair and Bush tried to basically say, "Well, this is an R2P invasion," but the R2P lobby themselves quickly distanced themselves from any such talk, but they're not going to be able to distance themselves from this talk or from this instance, because they've taken ownership of this invasion of Libya, the R2P crowd. And so much remains to be seen, but it's important for those of us who are critical to articulate these criticisms at this stage, and in as vigorously as we can in the coming days, because there's going to be a vigorous propaganda war waged by the RTP lobby. Whatever the outcome, they're going to still try and maintain that this was legitimate, that this was important to set this RTP precedent, when in fact it's highly dubious and highly questionable. As Falk says, you know, not at all a moral decision that's been made here.
Well, Anthony, in this country, whenever these kinds of situations have come up, Rwanda is immediately invoked. And, of course, Romeo Dallaire, the former Canadian general who was with the UN forces in Rwanda when that horrible massacre took place. And this has always been the great specter, the bogeyman, if you like, of inaction in these kinds of situations. What do you think, Anthony? I mean, I've seen in the United States now that the Americans are quick, at least on the face of things, to drop this hot potato into NATO's lap. And Canada, in the House of Commons, we did, as I mentioned in the intro, as the Americans did not, we had in the highest house of the land, we did have a vote on this, and all parties went along, a small proviso by the NDP. But what do you think of the Canadian response and involvement in Libya right now?
Well, it's an extension of the transformation of the Canadian foreign policy apparatus that we, myself and John Elmer, have discussed on the show a number of times. You know, this is the beyond Afghanistan that General Andrew Leslie, former head of the Army, was talking about when, in the midst of transforming Canada into a globally expeditionary counterinsurgency and other capabilities, when the result of this transformation, when he said, you know, Afghanistan is a model for the future, that's Libya, is the type of intervention that he would have had in mind. And to be able to be interoperable with its core allies in the NATO alliance, chiefly, of course, the U.S., is a main objective of the Canadian forces and the Canadian state strategically. And so the fact that a Canadian is going to be the titular head of the NATO mission is also a significant step in that direction. And, this speaks to, and to respond to your question, it speaks in terms of the consensus that now exists, on the record in the House of Commons for this explicit military sort of geostrategic posture that that the Canadian state has taken is rather disturbing. But it says a lot about the NDP in particular, because this has been a liberal conservative coalition government on national security and foreign policy issues since 2005, when Martin had his minority government. But now to see the NDP adding themselves to the mix, it's got to be depressing, because it poses serious strategic level issues for what remains of the left in Canada, who wants, if there's any kind of anti-imperialist bloc that exists, where do we go from here if in this context, in the context of this very serious decision on the part of the House of Commons, where is our recourse? Where do we go from here? And so, hopefully some of these questions will play out over the next 6 weeks as this federal election kicks into gear. It's actually encouraging to see, for example, Margaret Wendt, who's not known for being an anti-imperialist journalist, a Global Mail columnist, she's actually hit this on the head. She said, we've entered a new age, the age of humanitarian imperialism, advocates of which are besotted with fantasies of the West's inherent goodness. And those advocates now include the NDP and their counterparts in the Liberal and Conservative parties, and the Bloc, of course, too. Where do we go from here? It's a very important question for the left and for progressive forces who are opposed to such intervention. But, of course, there is a progressive side. There is a section of the left also supportive of this intervention. And so there are critical questions being raised that haven't been raised in years. And these are very interesting times in that respect.
Well, Anthony, I'd like to carry on, but I have to take a 30-second break. Will you indulge me and stay on the line?
Sure.
Okay. This is CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. You're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking with Anthony Fenton. We'll be back in just 30 seconds, but do first listen to this.
I'm hungry.
Me too.
And why is she eating that stuff? She must have picked it up from her trip back home. The smell's making me sick. Don't you think she should eat it somewhere else?
No, that's disrespectful toward Parveen. Actually, I think it's great that we can enjoy different foods.
What would you do if you were this witness? Safe Harbor Respect for All provides diversity workshops across Canada with funding from the Government of Canada. Visit safeharbor.ca. Respect for All. Pass it on.
So, Anthony, now you know the Canadian government has respect for all. When you mentioned that this, there's a double standard when it comes to R2P, or the responsibility to protect, or maybe I should say the respect for all to protect, where are some areas in the world that could use this? I mean, I'm thinking, you mentioned Richard Falk. He penned a report that was quite critical of Israel. Can the R2P doctrine be applied to Palestine?
Well, actually, funny enough, I interviewed Richard Falk when Israel was last bombing the hell out of Gaza, and you weren't seeing anybody make calls for R2P. In fact, I also interviewed R2P lobbyists and said, how come you're not sending out press releases calling for responsibility to protect Palestinians? And they said, well, I think we actually talked about this on the show, and they said, we don't want to belabor Israel. And Richard Falk, when I interviewed him, said, well, of course it applies to Palestine if it applies anywhere. And that is really the bottom line. Now, in the immediate context, now, of course, Gaza's been bombed just within the last few days, once again, by Israel, and the collective punishment being meted out against them that Falk courageously identified hasn't stopped either. But there's also this immediate context in the region of revolutionary uprisings, such as in Bahrain, that are being put down by Saudi Arabian army. You have other revolutionary forces that could, quote, use our protection, but because they're taking place in regimes that we're still friendly toward and want to continue to prop up, like in Yemen, we choose not to invoke the R2P principle. I mean, it's, if you read the chronology of the R2P lobby itself, it's just very clear, because now it's not just that the U.S. State Department or the White House isn't invoking R2P, right? Even the lobbyists themselves are very selective, because they know, basically, and the bottom line for them is what is politically palpable. You know, Paul Heinbecker, a former Canadian ambassador to the UN, said, to put it bluntly, the world is doing this in Libya because it can, but there's a limit to what it can do. Like, we can't protect everybody. We can only protect the ones where we can create a monster, like Gaddafi. And of course, you know, he's helped self-author that characterization to a certain extent. But because we can do it there, that we do it. You know, and that's, you know, as blunt as that is, it's basic. And yeah, and that's where we're at. I mean, these are the double standards, some of them, and they'll continue to exist until such a time as, you know, other the balance of forces shifts in the favor of the people who need it to.
Well, Anthony, I mentioned that there's an eerie parallel to the Clinton presidency here with Obama, but when Yugoslavia happened, there wasn't the kind of media there is now. What role do you think the new media, Twitter and Facebook and the cell phone technology, what role does that play, and how is it being used and misapplied in this instance, in Libya's case?
Well, I mean, I don't follow that too closely. I mean, what I follow is, you know, I'm on Twitter, you know, as I think you are as well, mm-hmm. and many others. But there's been that part, just basically, it's a new medium in the context of the R2P lobby, for example, where the propaganda war, the ideological war, is being carried out. You know, you had one of the biggest R2P lobbyist, his name's Mark Hannis. He runs something called the Genocide Prevention Network. He was calling very early for a no-fly zone over Libya. He was calling for drones to be, a part of that no-fly zone in Libya, because they've been used to such great effect in Pakistan and Afghanistan. And it's just really, I think it's an opportune medium for them to sort of coalesce, you know, and put out their message. And it just sort of, it has that viral nature to it. It hits you from all angles. But I don't think it makes their message any more, you know, disturbing or any less disturbing. You know, it just makes it more of a cacophony of imperialist intent. You know, like that's basically it. I mean, maybe you've got some ideas on that you'd like to share.
Well, I'm curious. My biggest question right now is the kind of weaponry that's being used in or against Libya. I know that the Canadian military swore off depleted uranium munition, some years ago. Firstly, Anthony, do you know if DU is being used in Libya? And do you know if the Canadian government now, as you say, like the Canadian military government after Afghanistan, will quietly drop their insistence that they don't use DU as many of their allies do in the future?
That's a good question. I know what Dave Lindorf, writing for Counterpunch, basically threw out, you know, the possibility that depleted uranium is being used. I don't know. I haven't yet seen any and the evidence of that, you'd think they'd know better than to do that, because, you know, it'll come back to kick them in the ass later on. But then again, they use it elsewhere, and they do it with impunity. Mm-hmm. So as far as Canadian policy goes, no, I doubt if they would retract that officially, but they would just probably come up with ways to justify how the planes that they were accompanying on bombing runs were using it, and that was morally acceptable to them, and you know, their hands were tied, or you know, what have you. But but then again, you never know. You're right. If we get into majority territory as a result of this election, and the conservatives have the mandate, as Harper keeps saying, to implement their real, you know, mask down vision for Canada, then, you know, you never know what kind of, in this new 21st century environment, which is disturbingly progressing at a pretty fast pace, these new methods of warfare, this cyber warfare, you know, and so forth, and this permanent global counterinsurgency, counterterror war. It's hard to say at this point, because, and the uncertainty of just how long we're going to be involved and engaged in wars in these regions, right? The rules always change to reflect adapting conditions on the ground. And so, you know, the imperialists who are waging this war are worried, right? I mean, John McCain, Senator McCain, the U.S., has been repeating this line, you know, these are the most dangerous times that we've seen, and he means it, right? He means it in the sense that we better bear down and be prepared to wage war for the foreseeable future, and who knows what implications that carries with it, and where Canada exactly is going to fit into that scheme. I mean, we're seeing it interoperable in Afghanistan, we're seeing these key positions that it's taken on in Libya, and as John has described, you know, on the ground in Israel-Palestine, things of that nature, that, you know, none of this should or would surprise any of us if Canada did do something like, you know, start dropping depleted uranium.
Well, finally, and I have to thank you, Anthony, for filling in for my missed first guest. What do you think the significance, what's the true significance of the proposed F-35 jet fighter purchase that Mr. Harper wishes to tie Canada to, although we don't know the price tag, another one of the grounds for his contempt of not only Parliament, but the Canadian taxpayer? What is the significance, and I'm still thinking of this post-Canada, post-Afghanistan, and its newfound militaristic recognition of itself. What is the significance of that purchase or proposed purchase, in your view?
Well, I think partly, you know, I mean, it's been, you know, the grounds on which it's been criticized, you know, by critics are a little bit overblown, because only to the extent that this is the kind of commitment that one should expect from a state that is committed to maintaining a U.S.-led system of imperialism globally. So it's perfectly logical that Canada should want a piece of the action and commit to it, to show its commitment to empire, to imperialism. And to this new Canadian face for the world. And so the implications in that sense are simple, right? I mean, it's just Canada just doing its part, stepping up to the imperialist plate, and taking a slice of the action. And so it should, of course, be opposed. You know, I mean, I don't like seeing that there are this cachet of fighter aircraft existing already to send over to these imperialist interventions in Libya. And so what are the implications of these F-35s, and what are the capabilities of these F-35s, and where, in what context are they going to be deployed in the future? Why does Canada need these capabilities, you know, if we're a peace-loving nation, you know? And so these are the implications that, concern me, and, you know, the dollar figures are another matter, because Canada, you know, spends and has, increased its military war expenditures to levels not seen since World War II, and that trajectory is going to continue. But again, that's part and parcel with this commitment to the imperial project more broadly. And so it's that we need to be posing fundamentally, not just these one-off little issues, relatively little issues, but the bigger picture of Canadian imperialism, and we need to oppose it on those grounds.
Well, Anthony Fenton, I thank you again doubly for coming on as you have today and gone overtime. You can find more of Anthony's work at his website, webofdemocracy.org, webofdemocracy.org. Thanks again, Anthony, and good luck with your finals, and we'll speak again, we hope.
Thanks a lot, Chris. Take care.
All right. Till the next time, then. I'm going to take a brief break now, and I'm hoping Janine has been patiently waiting for my call. But until we do that, why don't you listen to this?
Samba triste das incertas madrugadas, samba triste, ecos e passos nas calçadas, samba triste de São Paulo na neblina, na garoa muito fina, nas luzes amortecidas, samba tão triste. Samba triste das incertas madrugadas, samba triste, ecos de passos nas calçadas, samba triste de São Paulo na neblina, na garoa muito fina, nas luzes amortecidas. Samba tão triste, samba das almas vencidas. Cada boêmio que passa na rua sabe sonhar com a lua. Cada mulher mariposa de
asa. Welcome back to Guerrilla Radio CPV 101.9. Featuring Janine and Julio singing along with the music. How's it going, Janine?
Yeah, pretty good. They have a lot to say, these little doggies, I'll tell you. They'll tell you all about it. But I've given them a chewy, so hopefully they'll just chew on it. And we can talk about... Ibana just made a speech. Did you know about that?
No. I've been working all day.
Yeah, he apparently said nice things like, it was not in our national interest to let citizens of Benghazi be massacred by Gaddafi's forces. He said it was not in our national interest. There's some comments on the Twitter about how oil really is their national interest. And he said, we know that our own future is safer and brighter if more of mankind, not humankind, mankind, can live with the bright light of freedom and dignity. I'm convinced that a failure to act in Libya would have carried a far greater price for America. So some of the comments are about, the translation is basically, go back to bed, America. Your government is in control. The New World Order, it's all taken care of. One person wrote, I'm always amazed at how stupid Obama thinks we are. Interestingly, though, Chris, and this is the part that really freaks me out, is if I start looking at the Libyan tweeters, you know, like there's a group called Libya Without Borders, you know, usually the Without Borders people are pretty astute about these things, and these people are still defending You know, unless these are, you know, maybe it's a, what do you call that, psycho ops or whatever? Maybe they're
psyops,
just pretending?
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of that going on. There's a lot of psychological operations concerning new media happening. Phony avatars. One CIA guy, for example, with 50 identities going out and purporting to be this person or that or this organization or that. This is taken straight from the Israeli Hasbara, which is their propaganda campaign that was the latest incarnation of their long-running propaganda campaign. So yeah, it's really hard to know who you're speaking with. I mean, they tell this to children. You don't know who's on the other end. Well, it's the same principle, but a lot more sophisticated.
Yeah, yeah. It's interesting though, because it seems, you know, I mean, I'm pretty careful, and I can, you know, I'm careful who I follow here. But there's still sort of the sentiment that if, you know, that Gaddafi would have just massacred everybody and that they're better off with this. But isn't that how it started out in Kosovo or Yugoslavia?
Well, Yugoslavia was was a very complicated event, just like today, where it split people that would ostensibly be anti-war. They were, you know, some supported it. Shut up, Julio. I'm talking. And in Kosovo, briefly, NATO said that there were massacres going on. People on the ground said, no, there isn't any massacres going on. But NATO insisted that they had to drop bombs on Serbia, specifically on the I forgot the name of the city now. But everyone said, well, no, if you start dropping bombs on the city, on Belgrade, then the massacres will definitely be a backlash to what's going on. They didn't listen to that. Wesley Clark and the rest of Bill Clinton's people, they started bombing Belgrade. And, yeah, sure enough, like everyone said, there was actually a great exodus out of Kosovo before any of the bombing started. And American airplanes, under NATO's auspice, bombed Kosovar Albanians that were trying to get out, fearing something in the future, bombed them and made them turn around and go back. Like, they really needed to have this massacre. Yugoslavia is not cut and dry, and Libya is not cut and dry either. There's a very sinister hand behind this, behind both of these events, and the parallels are enormous.
Well, and yeah, and I mean, the military-industrial complex, you know, it's an economy. It's an economy,
yeah.
And a lot of people are employed in that industry, and they need to justify all their war machinery, and that really is, I think, the bottom line. And, you know, they're sort of look for excuses. Did you check out the Uncut movement on the weekend a little bit?
I've heard a bit about it, and Democracy Now! Had a good piece on the Uncut movement in Britain. Why don't you fill us in?
Yeah, they figure some estimates are, say, 500,000 people in London were out, and then there were people all over the U.S. in various cities, 10,000 in Los Angeles. Doesn't seem to have been much in Canada. Maybe people are putting their hope in a coalition government, which some people think that's evil, but to me it just sounds like some kind of cooperation, which seems like a good thing.
It sounds like communism to me.
It doesn't sound like communism. It just sounds like they're willing to actually listen to each other and work together, which I don't get what's so bad about that. But the Bank of America, you know, they shut down the Bank of America in Washington, D.C., and all these folks occupied this swanky shop in London, and a whole bunch of people got arrested, and they did. I would definitely recommend people go to democracynow.org and listen in. And, you know, they're really united. I mean, it's sort of interesting that the U.S. and Great Britain, I mean, at one time these people were fighting each other, right? And now they're united against the common enemy of tax dodgers.
Mm-hmm.
And they're really insisting that, you know, why should we have to pay for their bailout still and again? And, you know, these are the people that they got bailed out, and they still can't seem to get things working, and they're making all these big profits, and they're not paying taxes, and why should our jobs have to be cut? So that's really uniting them. At the same time, I think you sent me this notice about hundreds of thousands out in Germany protesting nuclear energy on the weekend. That's pretty cool.
Well, and they're in the middle of elections as well, which makes it all the more poignant. But it's funny because a friend of mine and I, we were in Germany in the last autumn, when Angela Merkel, the leader there, announced that she was going to extend the life of 12 nuclear power plants that were coming up for mothballing. You know, when these things were built, they said, okay, they're going to last for 30 years or 40 years or whatever it is. And it drew outrage because there's a great anti-nuclear sentiment within Germany anyway. What's gone on in Japan has just, has emboldened them. And, yeah, they're coming out into the streets in their tens of thousands.
Yeah, good for them. Good for them. There's also an interesting article from Venezuela about donating. They're going to continue to donate free fuel to poor families in the U.S. Who knew? Apparently Venezuela has been subsidizing poor people in the U.S. With heating fuel. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if they realize that there's this other and more northern nation that they might also help out. Of course, we want to move away from oil, but I found that was kind of interesting. I just want to mention, too, Chris, that the Street News, we're having our 7th birthday party. Can you believe we're 7 years old on Friday?
Wow. No, I can't.
I can't either, quite frankly, but we are, and so we're going to get together at the solstice. David has kindly allowed us to have the space at the solstice. We've got some music lined up, and people are invited. It'll be just for a couple hours, 7:30 to 9:30, get to know the vendors and the writers and chit-chat and all that sort of good thing. So that's Friday, April 1st. And then on April 2nd is the big Peace Arch Park International Rally from 2 till 6. And there are buses going from Vancouver. This is really the unions standing in solidarity with each other on either side of the border, talking about collective bargaining rights and solidarity and all that sort of thing. And so there are buses. The BC Federation of Labor will be providing buses. And you can write to buses@bcfed.ca to find out about that. And then there's a big day of democracy coming up April 6th. And this is to do with what you were telling me the other night about Remy Beauregard and the rights and democracy organization that had their funding cut, right?
Yeah, this is another scandal and also grounds for contempt of Parliament, as well as the shutting down of funding to Kairos by the Harper government and Rights and Democracy, another NGO that was giving grants to Palestinian peace groups and Israeli peace groups. I mean, heaven forfend that we support peace on two sides of a conflict. I mean, that just doesn't support Stephen Harper's vision of a militaristic Canada marching fourth bayonet first into the 21st century. But and Remy Beauregard was the president the chairman rather of Rights and Democracy, and he suffered a fatal heart attack after a particularly boisterous board meeting last year. And since then, Stephen Harper's appointees have basically hijacked that organization. That what's left of it, I'm not even sure it's going to survive at all.
April 6th, they're going to be out in Montreal for sure. And I think I heard Ottawa as well, but I can't say for sure. So that's something to look forward to. And then just to go back to where we started, Chris, I was remembering when we were talking about Libya, and you mentioned you have two sort of ideas of what is going on, and one had to do with the migration of people from Africa.
Well, now, of course I'm not an expert, but I'm looking at there's two very major situations and concerns concerning Libya and all of North Africa. The Europeans are very worried about in-migration of dispossessed Africans in their hordes, and which this has been happening at a more accelerated rate since the Tunisia uprising and what's happened in Libya, and Italy is bearing the biggest brunt of it so far. And the second is gas. There's tons of offshore gas deposits all along the Mediterranean rim of Africa, going right up past Lebanon. If you look in each one of these countries, there's major offshore gas drilling and some oil drilling going on. And it seems to me that a lot of these revolutions were possibly begun as a play to take over these governments and sign lucrative gas contracts for various people behind this. I think it's gotten a little out of their control. They didn't, I'm guessing, they didn't really understand just how deep the resentment in these countries goes, and how tenacious the uprisings could be. I'm no expert, but this is something that I don't hear a lot of in the media. But it seems like and when you don't hear the obvious things, you got to wonder why. But these are two very big situations.
Yeah, for sure. And it's also really interesting that all these leaders who get their countries blown up, Saddam Hussein, and I think you were saying Milosevic and Noriega and Gaddafi, at one time they all had the audacity to nationalize their resources, right?
Yeah, that's true. And to spend money on the people with education and healthcare and some of these other unmentionables rather than on giving big tax breaks to the corporations and the banks and the military.
Yeah, and sadly, I guess in Gaddafi's case, he didn't carry on with that, and so there's good reason why the people are upset with him. So, well, it's certainly interesting times that we live in, Chris.
Yeah, I guess we could end just about every sentence with that, but yeah. I suppose we'll end the show with it. Other than to say, your program, Winds of Change. hey, I said enough out of you. Winds of Change, alternating Thursdays at 11 a.m. right here at CFUV, and, of course, the Victoria Street News, the paper you publish on the streets now, and I guess your April edition is fast coming, eh?
April's there.
April's already out.
Yeah. We're looking for May 1st is coming up, so we can talk about that next week. With the labor issue is the sort of the focus of the April paper. Yeah.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot, Janine, for coming on and bearing with my a bit of a discombobulated show this week. And until the next time.
Yeah. Thank you, Chris.
All right. Bye bye. And thanks. A great big thanks to Anthony Fenton for coming in ahead of schedule and staying late to cover for us today. That's all I got for you for this week, but I will remind you to stick around because Rhythming's coming straight up with Arnold, and if you're a jazz fan, you'll love that. I'll play myself out again with what I got for donating to the station, because we all donate too, you know. This is a Putumayo disc of Acoustic Brazil. Oh, I just love this stuff. And this is Ana de Holanda.
Épocas de passos nas calçadas, samba triste. De São Paulo na neblina, na garoa muito fina, nas luzes amortecidas. Samba tão triste, samba das almas vencidas. Cada boêmio que passa na rua é sapo a sonhar com a lua. Cada mulher mariposa de asas queimadas. Que desencanto nessas vidas, pela neblina envolvidas, perdidas na madrugada. Que desalento em meu olhar, que tristeza em meu pisar. Sozinho na calçada, samba triste, das incertas madrugadas.